This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO. Helena Norberg Hodge is an internationally renowned environmentalist and an analyst of the impact of the global economy on cultures and agriculture worldwide. She's also a pioneer of the localization movement. She is the recipient of the Right Livelihood Award, which is also known as the Alternative Nobel Prize. She is founder and director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture and author of Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh. Helena Norberg Hodge will be in Portland this Friday for a special Portland screening of The Economics of Happiness, a new documentary film that she has made about the devastating effects of globalization and the need for localization. The event is this Friday, January 21st at 7 p.m. at the Main Street Sanctuary, First Unitarian Church. Helena's website is theeconomicsofhappiness.org. Helena Norberg Hodge, welcome back to KBOO.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you talk a little about why you decided to make this film, The Economics of Happiness?
Yes, I wanted to show that all around the world, there is a pattern that is almost identical in terms of the main trends. And everywhere you're seeing that governments, unfortunately, are pushing an economic growth agenda that's based on increasing global trade and subsidizing multinationals, both banks and other multinationals, and that this is having a devastating effect, not only in the U.S., but in China, for instance. This trend is leading to mass unemployment because it's destroying the livelihoods of millions of small farmers and small business people, pulling people into enormous urban centers. So the pattern is almost identical, but of course the realities in different places are different. And also I wanted to show that around the world, when you look closer at the grassroots, there are very positive trends where people start rebuilding the local community, local economy. You're seeing multiple benefits that are incredibly inspiring. So there is another path. There's this systemic direction that we could start moving in that would have enormous benefits to jobs as well as the environment. And you know, I was able to interview people from every continent to show that this is a reality, that there are these alternatives, that they are working, and that there are voices from different races, different cultures, who are all saying the same thing.
And maybe talk a little about the actual process of making this film.
Yes, it was quite a long process, and it involved, you know, doing a long shoot in China where I'd been invited to speak at the Academy of Social Sciences, and we then went out into the countryside, and we interviewed wonderful people. We did a whole shoot in France and in many other places. We have masses of footage that was translated, transcribed, and then edited. And the editing process meant that so much was cut out. For instance, we have only one voice from China now in the film, a very short clip, nothing from France. So it was immensely painful and difficult to have to cut out so many voices, so much footage. But in the end, I think we have something that shows that there's a chorus of voices and that there is this systemic direction that we should be focusing on. And I suppose one of the most important things that I want to convey is that the globalizing path of the economy is dividing people. It's polarizing people terribly. And so you see, especially in the industrialized world now, many small business people are getting very angry at the left and at environmentalists because they believe that they're the ones who are responsible for the destruction of their jobs because of their emphasis on labor unions and environmental protection and so on. And they're just not seeing the reality that the problem is an economic agenda. It's the economic system we need to focus on. When people come together in their local economies, actually finding this healing between environmentalists and other people, between left and right, between different races. And this, again, you can see around the world. So it's very, very encouraging. And I just so hope that people will wake up to this, because we could have a very powerful movement for meaningful political change if we only had more economic literacy, and economic literacy from a global point of view.
And why did you call the film The Economics of Happiness?
Because at the ultimate and deepest level, coming together with our communities and reconnecting to the place where we live, to the plants and the flora and the fauna, knowing our place on this planet, is essential for a deep psychological security that is the foundation of happiness. It's particularly important for children that they have those connections beyond the little nuclear family, beyond the stress and the strain of an economic system where people are rushing so fast that they don't have time to look after themselves, after their children, after their parents. The speed of this system is horrendous and so completely unnecessary. We're artificially creating unemployment and speed by subsidizing businesses to continue to use ever more technology and energy at the expense of people. So we're subsidizing unemployment and pollution simultaneously. But to see that, we've got to look more deeply. And when we do, we'll see that that speed and competition, the competition for scarce jobs, is the main cause of unhappiness. At every level, it's creating stress and strain within ourselves, between ourselves and others, and between us as a society and the environment. But the other path, the localizing path, is actually also a path that helps us to slow down. It can be hard, I suppose, to believe what I'm saying until you start studying it, but I would urge people to go to our website, look at all the materials, and then look on the ground for yourself. Once you start studying the phenomenon of localization, you'll see that there are demonstrations of what I'm saying right now.
And again, that website is the THE and then economicsofhappiness.org. You are known for your background with the Ladakh people. Can you talk a bit about that? Because it does form the basis for some of your premise in the film.
It does. And I think I really want to stress that what happened in Ladakh was that I was put in this very unique position of arriving in a place that had been sealed off from the outside world for generations, since the 40s. It was thrown open in 1975, and I came out as part of a film team. I was going to be there only for a few weeks, and I was a linguist, and I'd been asked to pick up some of the language. Well, I came in contact with a culture that had evolved and developed and changed over centuries according to its own needs, trading on its own conditions, not pressured by outside giants, either economic, you know, political, economic corporate giants or political giants. And what I came across was this astounding wealth and incredible joy and vitality. I had never met people who were so deeply contented. And over the years, because I decided to stay, I was fascinated by the place. I decided to work on the language. And speaking the language fluently, I became aware that this incredible joy and vitality was connected to deep self-esteem that in turn was connected to very close, harmonious community ties. And among other things, you know, that a mother had roughly 10 live-in caretakers for every baby, which of course provides the baby with a sense of just open arms. You know, when the baby's ill, no one gets tired and exhausted. It just moves from arm to arm. And so I really experienced that. And I also saw that one of the key reasons why people are abandoning their own self-respect and their own cultures and their own communities is that there's enormous psychological pressure that romanticizes a fast-paced, competitive, urban consumer culture. And children end up feeling that they're nobody, that they're not going to get the love and respect from their peer group if they don't have the latest gadgets, the latest clothing, and as they get older, the latest car, the latest this. And of course, this is a path that leads to competition and envy, not to the affirmation, the respect, and at the deepest level, the love that we all long for, and especially as little children, we're so vulnerable. So I had my eyes open to that in Ladakh. I also saw that unemployment was suddenly created. It had never existed before. And that in turn led to friction between local groups that had lived peacefully side by side for 500 years. I also wrote a book about that, Ancient Futures, and we made a film by the same title, and we had enormous interest from around the world, mainly grassroots, but an amazing phenomenon where it's been translated into almost 50 languages. And in that process, I was in contact, you know, with hundreds of different groups around the world and discovered that this was a general pattern. And so I've studied it around the world, and I've found, for instance, around the world that not only is the identity of children being destroyed and how that leads to unhappiness, but how the competition, ethnic friction, racism, fundamentalism is on the increase. But I also found that this is linked very practically to an economic system that is importing and exporting identical products around the world. So the U.S. exports about 900,000 tons of beef and veal and turns around and imports about 900,000 tons of beef and veal. The U.K. exports as much milk and butter as it imports. This process of completely unnecessary trade is linked to the main cause of global warming and of unemployment. And I just think that people are really ready to see that, you know, there is a path that could take us towards fuller employment, 100% employment, and less pollution. So I'm really, really passionate about people understanding that this is a process that's happening around the world, and that it isn't about Ladakh, nor just about the United States, or just about India or China. This is a pattern, that if we understand that pattern, we'll feel more hopeful. We'll see that the dominant dialogue in the media and so on makes us feel like we as individuals are totally to blame for these disasters. We are greedy and continually, you know, wanting to consume forever more, and we're destroying the planet, we're destroying the livelihood of poor people in the third world. This is a very false perspective that leaves people feeling very guilty, disempowered, and exhausted. Really understanding what's going on is just in itself a path towards happiness. And we'll discover that there is another path that will be deeply meaningful on every level.
I'm speaking with Helena Norberg Hodge. She is an internationally renowned environmentalist and an analyst of the impact of the global economy on cultures and agriculture worldwide. She will be in Portland this Friday at 7 p.m. at the Main Street Sanctuary at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, and she will be at a showing of the film we are talking about called The Economics of Happiness. Her website is theeconomicsofhappiness.org. You know, the statistics that you mentioned there, the fact that the United States imports as much as it exports of certain products.
Yes, and I find it so tragic that more people are not aware of this. And we're not talking about, you know, when you're exporting and importing identical products, you know, people should really understand this is not about importing something that you can't produce. You're importing something that you are producing. The end result is that around the world, you'll find that a product from 10,000 miles away will generally cost much less than a product from 1 mile away. This, to me, I hope, you know, people will really think about this, because this is an expression, a truth about what's happening in our economy that shows that it's to do with hidden subsidies and manipulation. International trade has been part of our history, literally going back to, you know, thousands of years. In Ladakh, which is actually part of Tibet, they traded, you know, going back 1,000 years and had things literally from the other side of the world. But their basic needs, the food they needed every day, the staple food came from the region. That makes a lot of sense. You know, food is something that everybody needs every day of their life. It makes sense that that should come from closer to home. But we have a system right now where the subsidies and taxes encourage us producing huge monocultures to be shipped to the other side of the world and using more and more energy and machinery and less human care and intelligence. If I could add to that, that there are now studies coming out, one of the most important being something called the IAASTD, which was commissioned under the auspices of the World Bank and the UN. with the blessing of the U.S. government, the U.K. government, and so on. It was a three-year study looking at agricultural science and technology and what way forward. And it involved 300 experts, three-year study involving about 30 or 40 countries. When the results came out, the study was absolutely silenced. No one has heard of it. And yet it's an incredibly important study that shows that if we continue in the direction of large-scale industrial agriculture, as the head of the report said, we're going to be living on a planet no one wants to inhabit. And it's pointing towards the need for more diversified, smaller-scale agriculture as not only providing more satisfying jobs and diversity on the land, which is absolutely essential to keep the soil healthy and to avoid pollution, but the diversified smaller-scale agriculture is also more productive per unit of land. So on a crowded planet, we really have no choice. We need to have fuller employment and less pollution. And this is what small-scale diversified agriculture, providing for smaller markets closer to home, can offer.
Helena Norberg-Hodge, the power of corporations and globalization sometimes seems so vast and so present. How do we counter it?
Well, I really believe that the main thing that stands between us and the beginnings of a shift, a meaningful political shift, is that we believe that we can't take control of corporations. That is what I think is the biggest obstacle. We need to step back again to see the bigger picture. First of all, to understand that the people who are pushing for further globalization constitutes something like 1% of the global population. Not even that, that's 60 million people. The active proponents that are pushing in the direction, and let's please remember that we're not talking about, oh, globalization is already there, we can't change it. We're talking about choosing to support a path, a systemic shift in one direction or another direction. So whatever we do, things are going to be changing. So don't talk about status quo and this is something that's there and can't be changed. It is being changed. If we can understand that that's happening and let our voices be heard to make it very clear that we don't want further trade treaties that deregulate the global players, the global banks and corporations, we saw with the financial collapse or near financial collapse that banks need regulation. While the financial speculation and banks are completely linked to the movement of goods, to this insane trade of importing and exporting water and live animals, they're completely linked. And so we need to understand that we need regulation for trade, not just in money, but in water and animals and across the board. That is regulation of the global players or the multinational corporations. Preventing further globalization is a step that would not be so difficult. I think there would be a lot of willingness on the part of policymakers if there were a movement, a linked-up movement where social and environmental movements link up, left and right link up, to see that they have a common agenda. I think this could happen relatively quickly. And once that has happened, we're talking about the world getting a bit of a respite, being able to pause a bit. The constant onslaught and speed and increasing unemployment would not continue. Sadly, a lot of ecologists and environmentalists are buying into an agenda which is really a corporate agenda, which is that we just need more and faster ecological technology and that that's going to solve our problem. We need to look more broadly and deeply to understand, no, we need a shift in direction towards strengthening a multitude of businesses and jobs, a real shift towards supporting smaller and medium-sized businesses, towards ensuring that businesses are under an umbrella of political regulation, not shaping politics, shaping the economy and politics as they are now, which is what they can do as global players. So basically, businesses need to operate at a scale that is no greater than the political scale. And I think it's a really important thing to recognize that very often people on the left have always thought we need to scale up governance, have bigger and stronger government. But I am arguing that we need to scale down business, and that scaling down business is very important because smaller businesses are more responsive to both the social needs, the community needs, and the environment than giant businesses can be. I don't believe that the problem is bad people in the corporations, good people outside. I believe the problem is bad structures versus better structures. Structures that can respond to real diversity, real entrepreneurship, real individualism would be smaller, more flexible structures that would be more visible and more accountable. So this idea of scaling down business, which of course it's not all going to happen overnight, but what could happen overnight is preventing these giants from becoming even bigger. And if I could also just add that, in fact, what is happening overnight is that where people realize the huge benefits of shortening distances and supporting smaller businesses, you are seeing enormous benefits from localization, particularly in the local food movement. And there, you know, there's all the evidence there, if anyone wants to study it, that it employs more people in a happier, more meaningful employment. It's not huge monocultures where you're standing like a machine all day or as a migrant laborer being paid almost nothing. This smaller scale diversified farming is very satisfying, and farmers are being paid twice as much, sometimes three times as much, sometimes even more in the localized system than they are in the supermarket global giant system. So there's a huge win-win strategy there that also starts bringing down the price of fresh, healthy, local food to the consumer.
And can you talk about localization beyond the local food movement? What else is happening in that area that you see as part of this hopefulness?
Yes, there are very exciting developments where we're getting business alliances, again, across the world, where small businesses are linking up and jointly educating consumers about the multiple benefits of supporting local businesses, because the money circulates around the community and stays much longer. Someone recently made the point to me that it's a little bit like water in a healthy watershed that seeps in slowly, rather than the water that just gushes through and, you know, pavement, leaving the land dry. So the money circulates around. When you buy from local businesses, you're often having, out of $100, you'll have $45 staying in the community, rather than if you buy from a big franchise, it's something like $13. So these multiple benefits of economic healing and community healing and the reduction in transport, packaging, and other forms of pollutants. So these business alliances are growing very rapidly, and one of the better known ones in America is BALEE, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which is spreading and growing by leaps and bounds because people are seeing the benefits on the ground. There are also very exciting developments where local people are realizing these benefits and putting up local revolving funds. In some small communities, as much as $1.5 million have been raised to support the revitalization of the local economy. There's also the recognition that when you support your local credit union, you're supporting local jobs, you're supporting banks that are more stable, that are not too big to fail, and banks that lend responsibly. They tend to know their customers. This knowing each other and knowing who's reliable, knowing one another, is such a key to healthy business and healthy societies. It's important to look in our local area at what the Chamber of Commerce is doing, because sadly, in most places, the dominant trend is for them to just blindly support investment from the outside, and to support the big businesses coming in, and in effect, the outside investments are investments by people outside. What does that mean? It means that they're putting money in because they want to extract much more. When you have a local investor investing, they're not extracting the money outwards. So it's a really important thing for us to think about. When we get investment from the outside, we are talking about an investment that absolutely, certainly is going to be taking more money out than it puts in. They wouldn't invest if they weren't. This is a basic economic truth and why we need economic literacy to restore a healthy economy. So what's happening now is that in some areas, there's another movement that's very exciting, the Transition Town Movement. And there, whole groups in towns are coming together to look at what they can do to strengthen the local economy, to reduce their dependence on oil, and rebuild healthy employment and a healthy community. And there, in many cases, they're beginning to establish an alternative chamber of commerce. Or in some cases, people are getting onto the chamber of commerce and beginning to change the thinking there. So there are many, many exciting things happening at the local level that are truly inspiring and that are not just ideas, but they are a vision that's being put into practice that's demonstrating these multiple benefits.
And the film makes a point that localization is happening worldwide.
That's right. And I can't tell you how thrilling it is to talk to people around the world about the benefits, because they will also tell you that it starts rebuilding community and it starts bridging the divide between left and right. You can see in many cases farmers who were really angry at environmentalists and you know, often near bankruptcy. And when they join a farmer's market, I've had farmers say to me that I've been a farmer all my life and I felt like I was a serf, you know, delivering to this faraway city and the traders, and always pressured to lower the price, to increase the quantities. Now, selling in a farmer's market is like being in a different galaxy. This is what an Australian farmer said to me. And it is. They are now encouraged to diversify, which is more fun, it's more ecological, it does lower the demand for expensive external inputs, and they have this direct contact with the consumers that they really enjoy. And it really, very often, it is left meeting right, as environmentalists meet farmers who previously, were of a very different mindset.
Well, Helena Norberg-Hodge, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us here at KBOO, and want to let people know again that you will be in town this Friday night for the screening of The Economics of Happiness. That's at the First Unitarian Church, which is at 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue here in Portland. That starts at 7 p.m. KBOO is a co-sponsor of that event. Very interesting to hear you talk about this and to see the film. Thank you so much, Helena Norberg-Hodge.
Thank you.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for KBOO.